Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings. How some have been deposed, some slain in war, some haunted by the ghosts they have deposed. Some poisoned by their wives, some sleeping killed, all murdered. For within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king keeps death his court, and there the antic sits, scoffing his state and grinning at his pomp, allowing him a breath, a little scene, to monarchize, be feared and kill with looks, infusing him with self and vain conceit. As if this flesh which walls about our life were brass impregnable and humored thus, comes at the last and with a little pin, bores through his castle wall and farewell king. Shakespeare, Richard II, Act 3, Scene 2. The Wars of the Roses defined political life in England for two generations. From 1455 to 1485, sporadic outbursts of insane violence rocked what had once been Europe's most stable state. Brutal battles left thousands of dead. The greatest noblemen in the realm were unceremoniously beheaded, their families ruined. Kings rose and kings fell. In our last episode, we talked about the origins of the Wars of the Roses. The great warrior king Henry V had conquered northern France and brought England to its high point during the long and devastating Hundred Years' War. But his untimely death in 1422 brought his infant son Henry VI to the throne. By all accounts, Henry VI was pious, kind, and generous. He was also totally incapable of ruling, both as a child and eventually as an adult. Even after leaving infancy behind, Henry remained absent, vacant, and unable to focus on the business of state. Above all, Henry VI was totally allergic to making decisions. All medieval government, but especially that of England, revolved around the person of the king. There was an increasingly sophisticated machinery that administered law and taxation and allowed the king to make war as he chose. But that machinery didn't run on its own. It required an active king at the center. Decision-making was key to running the whole machine, and only the king could legitimately make those decisions. Other people could try to wield royal authority without royal direction, but they would never be the king. There would always be questions about their right to wield that royal authority. This was the essence of the political crisis that created the Wars of the Roses. With an absent, incapable king, who would make the decisions that ran the government? How would they justify and maintain their power? Over the course of the 1450s, those tensions built and built as various key nobles made their claim on ruling in place of the vacant Henry VI. There was a brief slip in 1455, but things really snapped in 1459. Two factions emerged. The Yorkists, the backers of Richard, Duke of York, and the Lancastrians, the partisans of King Henry VI's wife, Queen Margaret of Anjou. When we left off last time, the Lancastrians were temporarily triumphant. They had captured the Duke of York on December 30th, 1460, and executed him, along with his son and his major ally, the Earl of Salisbury. Their heads, the Duke of York's wearing a mocking paper crown, were placed above the gates of the city of York. This might have ended the conflict if not for a pair of sons. Edward, the Earl of March, the 18-year-old son of the beheaded Duke of York, and Richard Neville, Earl of Warwick, the son of the executed Earl of Salisbury. The Earl of Warwick was a wily, nasty political operator, maybe the sharpest and most powerful man in England. He was the undoubted power behind the Yorkist effort. In Edward, the Earl of March, Warwick had a capable youth who might do great things, if he could survive the disaster of his father's death and the rising tide of Lancastrian power. As 1461 dawned, things looked bleak for Edward and the Earl of Warwick. Queen Margaret's faction ruled. Edward, Warwick, and the rest of their Yorkist supporters had been declared traitors and attainted by law. Their estates had been confiscated. They were disinherited forever. It looked like the end was near. But Edward, Earl of March, was no ordinary 18-year-old. He was charismatic and likable, a young man with the talent and education to rise high among the English nobility. He was already a strong, barrel-chested 6'4". He would have been tall and striking today, but in 1461, Edward was a giant. He towered head and shoulders above his contemporaries, but softened the intimidation factor with an easygoing nature and a keen understanding of how noble society functioned. Above all, he was personally brave and had a sharp eye for military tactics and strategy. The Lancastrians immediately put young Edward to the test. When his father died, the 18-year-old was in Wales, chasing a Lancastrian force led by the important nobleman Jasper Tudor. Edward met Tudor in the Welsh borderlands at a place called Mortimer's Cross. This was Edward's first great victory, and it marked the beginning of a sterling military reputation. In the aftermath, Edward had a number of captured Lancastrian noblemen executed. Among them was the elderly Owen Tudor, father of Jasper Tudor. This Owen Tudor was the ultimate ancestor of the future Tudor dynasty. We'll come back to those Tudors shortly. As Edward marched east from Wales, his ally, the Earl of Warwick, was growing increasingly insecure in London. Yet another Lancastrian army was looting and burning its way south toward the capital. Warwick had old King Henry VI in his possession, and he had a tenuous hold on the city of London, but he had no choice but to leave the capital and meet Queen Margaret in battle. On February 17, 1461, the two armies caught up to each other at the city of St. Albans, where the first explosion of violence had begun the conflict back in 1455. After so much blood spilt, so many heads rolling onto the ground, that felt like a lifetime ago. The first Battle of St. Albans had been a Yorkist victory. They weren't so lucky the second time. The Lancastrians routed Warwick's army and sent the Earl packing, along with most of his supporters. As the screams and cries melted away into the winter evening and silence descended on the battlefield, the Lancastrians found one strange figure sitting under a tree. King Henry VI, formerly Warwick's prisoner, laughing and singing and passively awaiting his fate. Henry changed hands yet again. The titular king was an empty vessel into which each side poured its ambitions to rule England. But for how long? The now deceased Richard, Duke of York, had made his own claim on the throne just before his death. Parliament and the broader community of English nobles hadn't confirmed him as king, but in a compromise mood, they had named him heir to Henry VI. Under this agreement, when Henry died, it would be the Duke of York and not Henry's 7-year-old son, Prince Edward, who would inherit the throne. By executing Richard, Edward, Earl of March, and the Earl of Warwick argued, the Lancastrians had breached that agreement. It was null and void. This meant that Richard's son and successor, Edward, inherited not just the Duchy of York, but also his beheaded father's claim to the throne itself. In the chaos of early 1461, with the vengeful Queen Margaret loose in the English countryside, Warwick defeated at St. Albans and the kingdom in an uproar, Edward had only one real option: to formally declare himself king and let the chips fall where they may. He wouldn't be any more dead if he were defeated as a failed king than as a rebel duke. It was win or die, either on the battlefield or at the hands of Queen Margaret's executioners. And so, in early March 1461, Edward swore to the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Chancellor of England, and the lords assembled in Westminster that, quote, he should truly and justly keep the realm and the laws thereof maintain as a true and just king. Edward wasn't crowned. A formal coronation would have to wait. But the claim was in the open, and at least some people bought in. For them, he was King Edward IV. Claiming the throne was one thing. Now Edward would have to win it in open battle. On both sides, Yorkist and Lancastrian, enormous armies began to assemble. everywhere from the Scottish borderlands to Wales, from Cornwall to Kent, even from overseas, soldiers poured into the two opposing camps. There were Welsh archers and knights from Burgundy across the English Channel, foot soldiers from East Anglia, and light horsemen from Northumbria. According to later estimates, probably a slight exaggeration, more than 100,000 soldiers had assembled by the end of March. The Lancastrians had managed to slap together more troops, probably because more of the kingdom's great nobles were still siding with them over Edward and the Yorkists. But numbers were only part of that equation. Leadership mattered, too, and the newly minted King Edward was proving himself to be a gifted tactician and strategist. He brought his army north into Yorkshire to meet the Lancastrians who were headed south. The two sides first met on Saturday, March 28th, when Edward entrapped a large contingent of Lancastrians and utterly wiped them out. Among the dead was Lord Clifford, who had stabbed Edward's younger brother Edmund through the heart just a few months before. The real showdown came the following day, Palm Sunday, March 29th, 1461, near the village of Towton. It was a brutally chilly morning. The temperatures hovered just around freezing. The thick slabs of steel armor worn by the well-off on both sides were cold to the touch. Sword blades froze into scabbards. Horses stamped and pawed at the frozen ground, their breath visible in the foggy early spring air. Snowflakes started to fall, mixing with sleet and freezing rain as the two armies wheeled into position. With the howling wind at their backs, the Yorkists unleashed a hail of arrows and gunfire. The Lancastrians charged down the slope of a short ridge at their adversaries. Swords and pole axes slammed into armor and flesh. Thousands upon thousands of arrows whizzed through the air. The occasional blast of a cannon or a handgun was barely audible over the screams, the war cries, and the heavy collisions of steel on steel. All the while, snow and sleet poured out of the sky, turning the battlefield into a churning mess of mud and blood. As they fought hour after hour in the early morning chill, the sun rising imperceptibly behind the veil of fog and clouds, the two lines wheeled to a 45-degree angle. The Lancastrians' backs had been forced up against a flooded field and the hill they had come down in the first place. As they bent and broke under the Yorkist onslaught, the fleeing Lancastrians were trapped. Some tried to flee up the hill, others swam through the flooded field and the river beyond. The Yorkists pursued them and cut them down without mercy. So many dead jammed a nearby river that the later runners crossed to safety on top of their drowned corpses, a literal bridge of bodies. Edward had won. The 18-year-old king had made good his claim on the throne in open battle. King Henry and Queen Margaret weren't present at Towton. They had stayed well back, and now they fled for the safety of Scotland with a smattering of allies. The Duke of Somerset and the Duke of Exeter, Jasper Tudor, a few others, but their cause was effectively done for the time being. While the worthless and now deposed King Henry VI, his Queen Margaret of Anjou, and his young heir Prince Edward made their way to safety, thousands of Lancastrians hadn't been so lucky. Their corpses littered the battlefield. 5 centuries later, in the 1990s, archaeologists excavated a mass grave from the battle. Nearly 40 bodies had been dumped into a shallow pit. All of them were men over the age of 16. Aside from one old-timer, all were under the age of 45. Their skeletons show a multitude of horrific injuries. One man has a total of 8 blade wounds to the head, including one that diagonally cut his head in half from the crown of the skull down to the bottom corner of his mouth. Another has a neat opening punched in the side of his head from the sharp spike of a poleaxe, a wicked combination of axe and spear mounted on a 6-foot shaft. One man's face has a distinctive hole with small fractures radiating outward, the product of an impact from a high-velocity weapon. In this case, an armor-piercing arrow had struck him right in the forehead and punched into his skull. Still others had their heads caved in with blunt weapons, probably war hammers or the blunted backside of a poleaxe. Another had a metal object, probably a corroded arrowhead, lodged in his spine. Wounds to the hip, knee, and buttocks were common, all targets that were less armored and therefore vulnerable to attack. After death, all had been stripped of their armor, their weapons, and their valuables, and dumped unceremoniously into this mass grave. Who were these men? How and why did they end up horribly mangled and covered by a shallow layer of earth in a Yorkshire field? The answer to those questions reveals much about how English society as a whole, not just political society, actually functioned. This was a profoundly hierarchical society. Nobody had any doubt that some people were greater than others, and that pretty much everybody deserved their allotted place within that society. The king at the top, the great nobles below him, lesser nobles below them, gentry below them, then townspeople and peasants. Churchmen had their own parallel hierarchy. Pope, bishops, and so on. What made this a hierarchical society, rather than a collection of horizontal interest groups, were vertical ties that bound people together. The king had relationships with his nobles based on grants of land, awards of offices, and less formal links forged through military service or even just friendship. The great nobles were tied to lesser nobles and even gentry by marriage and by their own grants of land and offices. They also arbitrated disputes and provided justice for lesser aristocrats. Up-and-coming lawyers, common folk, provided services for nobles and relied on them for patronage. Towns relied on nobles or the king for protection and patronage of their own. At the very bottom, even humble peasants were tied to gentry or greater nobles if they lived and worked on their land, which pretty much everybody did. These hierarchical relationships defined medieval society in every way. They were its foundation, its glue, and the lubricant that made the various pieces move together smoothly. There was no shame in service to someone greater than oneself. Very much the opposite. To serve was honorable and praiseworthy. The nature of service and of those relationships changed over the course of the Middle Ages, though. By 1461, classic feudalism, land for military service enforced by a ceremony of formal homage, well, that was long dead. What replaced it was a variety of ties, both formal and informal. Some of them were just long-term relationships of advantage, you know, friendship for both the lesser and the greater party, usually within a particular locality, a particular place. But most of them were more structured than that. A great lord had members of his immediate household, his officials who occupied formal posts, and his counselors, all of whom had subordinates of their own. These were a lord's natural dependents. Beyond that immediate circle, which wasn't small for anybody of real status, there were additional categories. Extraordinary retainers who could be paid an annual fee for their loyalty, and those indentured by formal contract to provide this many men for service at this specified cost. Beyond that, a lord could distribute his livery, his badge, basically, to create short-term ties. All of these categories of subordinates implied military service for a greater lord. When that greater lord called, they answered, and so it went down the social scale. From the greatest lords, like the Duke of York or the Earl of Warwick, down to lesser nobles, down to the gentry, down to humbler but still well-off men-at-arms wearing expensive armor, down to well-trained archers and foot soldiers, and from there down to the cannon fodder. Payment was implied for all of these, whether formal or informal. That was what set these relationships apart from old-school feudalism, and it's why modern historians often call this social system bastard feudalism. It wasn't any more or less laudable than what had preceded it. In fact, by 1461, it had been in place for a long time. This was how English armies had been recruited during the Hundred Years' War, and was mostly how they were recruited in the Wars of the Roses. It's likely that many of the men killed at Towton were veterans of the French Wars, or the sons of veterans. One skeleton in the mass grave showed evidence of a long life of war, including a well-healed sword cut along his jaw. Whether they were old soldiers or not, the occupants of the mass grave at Towton had all been drawn there by the social and monetary ties of a hierarchical society. Gentry to serve lords, men-at-arms to serve gentry, archers to serve men-at-arms, and so on. Whether they wanted to be there or not was immaterial. To live in this society required service, and they served, all the way to death. The 40 men in that mass grave were just a tiny portion of Towton's cost. It was the bloodiest battle of the Wars of the Roses, the bloodiest ever fought on English soil, and one of the most lethal of the entire Middle Ages. According to one estimate, 20,000 men were dead. For decades, centuries afterward, farmers plowing the fields pulled up human remains. They were a reminder of the cost of Edward IV's throne and the ultimate consequence of Henry VI's utter, total incompetence.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Towton was that rarest of commodities in history, a truly decisive battle. It tore the heart out of the Lancastrian cause. Most of England's great nobles had been on the Lancastrian side, or at least leaned that way. But after Towton, most of them came around to Edward. Only the real diehards, the ones who had benefited most from Queen Margaret's rule, held out or followed her and the king into exile. I talked about this in some depth last week, but most of England's nobility, from the top down into the gentry, just wanted a royal government that functioned, a government headed by a legitimate king. As long as Henry VI was legitimate, they were going to support it. But after Edward's victory at Towton, the young man looked like the better bet to provide functioning government, as opposed to the feckless Henry VI and his vengeful wife, Queen Margaret of Anjou. Edward had at least a token claim to legitimacy, and he had validated his claim in blood on the battlefield. The lack of the will to rule had been Henry VI's defining characteristic. Edward IV, on the other hand, had that will to rule in spades. He also had strong ideas about precisely how he wanted to rule England. Those ideas encompassed both looks and reality, both the appearance of power and how he planned to exercise it. Luckily for England, Edward was talented. Luckily for Edward, England was sick and tired of civil war and ineffective kingship in 1461. They were ready to give him a shot. Edward was crowned in the spring of 1461 and called his first parliament later that year. His early reign showcased his strong instincts for kingship. He offered mercy to former Lancastrians, most of whom took him up on the offer. Legal commissions went out into the counties and shires to deliver up the royal justice that had so long been absent during Henry's ineffectual rule. There were rulings and executions both, enough to restore peace to troubled lands and to end long-standing noble feuds. Edward was going about the Herculean task of restoring confidence in a legal system that had failed to do its job for a long time. This was a tough task, but Edward mostly succeeded. To his friends, especially the powerful Earl of Warwick, Edward dispensed patronage in the form of lands and offices. Other long-term Yorkists were similarly rewarded. These were the kinds of minor lords and gentry that we talked about a little while ago, who orbited around the household of a great lord. In this case, we're talking about people who had been deeply connected to the old Duke of York, the people who had supported Richard during the turbulent 1450s. Edward IV used these people as the core of his new base of support. The king's two younger brothers, Richard, the Duke of Gloucester, and George, the Duke of Clarence, were also linchpins to this new strategy of rule. There were still some Lancastrians out there, and the newly crowned king set out to deal with them. Wales was a problem area, and it took years and a few sieges to drive out the last of Queen Margaret's supporters. It wasn't until 1464 that the last Lancastrians in the north of England were driven out of their castles, and Edward had to repulse a few full-scale efforts at invasion, too. There was betrayal as well. Some of the lords Edward had pardoned remained secret allies of the queen, exiled up in Scotland, and they continued working on her behalf. Henry VI had been smuggled back into England by some of those supporters. The last embers of conflict weren't smothered out until Edward took possession of the old, pathetic king in 1465. Henry had been hiding out with communities of monks and with sympathetic lords, but eventually Edward's men found him sheltering in a forest. They took Henry VI to the Tower of London, where he remained a prisoner. By that point, something wild and unexpected had happened. Normally, kings married foreign princesses. This was the basic substance of international diplomacy as it existed during this period. Marriages bound together dynasties and forged alliances. They oriented kingdoms toward each other and created strong, durable links. As an eligible bachelor, Edward was expected to cement his rule over England and his foreign policy by choosing one of Europe's eligible royal women. Warwick especially had plans for Edward's marriage. There was a Burgundian option that looked good. Isabella of Castile, the future queen and sponsor of Columbus, was also available. And finally, there was a French princess named Bona of Savoy, who would secure the final, lasting peace between England and France with a marriage. It was this French match that Warwick wanted. The Earl spent a great deal of time negotiating and working on it, and by late 1464, everything was ready to go. But as it turned out, Edward was already married, and not to a foreign princess. He had stumbled, quite literally, on a 26-year-old widow of a Lancastrian lord and member of the lower nobility named Elizabeth Woodville. No king of England had married one of his subjects in centuries. The last one had been Edward the Confessor before the Norman Conquest. That was more than 400 years ago. Elizabeth had dark eyes and auburn hair, and she was quite beautiful. Edward was smitten and married her in secret. There are all sorts of arguments that can be made about what exactly Edward thought he was doing here. Maybe he didn't want to commit to a foreign marriage and determine his foreign policy so early in his reign. Maybe he wanted to build a new power base using Elizabeth's large and talented family. Maybe he wanted to make a grand gesture of reconciliation by marrying the widow of a Lancastrian nobleman who had died fighting against him. All those are possible, even plausible. But the basic fact is that Edward IV married Elizabeth Woodville because he loved her. Everything else was just icing on the cake. The Earl of Warwick had invested a great deal of energy and prestige on negotiating that French marriage alliance with Bona of Savoy. When Edward revealed his secret marriage to Elizabeth Woodville, Warwick wasn't happy about it. What's more, the Woodville family immediately set about moving into the highest ranks of the nobility with alarming speed. The new queen was one of a large brood that was already notorious for reaching for the next rung on the social ladder. Elizabeth's five sisters all made marriages with exalted lords, like the Duke of Buckingham. Elizabeth's two sons by her first marriage both married well, and her brother Anthony Woodville married a wealthy heiress. Through Elizabeth's family, Edward IV created a series of powerful relationships with the high nobility of England that he hoped would keep him on the throne in turbulent times. More and more, that turbulence was starting to come from the Earl of Warwick. Warwick the Kingmaker, they called him, and many whispered that he, not Edward, was the true ruler of England. One ambassador wrote to Louis XI, the King of France, that England had, quote, two rulers, Warwick and another whose name I have forgotten. Warwick meant to be the power not just behind the throne, but alongside it. He was unquestionably the most powerful nobleman in England. When he grew dissatisfied with Edward's rule, the man he had helped put on the throne, there was bound to be trouble. Those problems came in fits and starts. First, one of Elizabeth Woodville's brothers married a relative of Warwick's. This might not have bothered the Earl, but for the fact that the bride was 65 years old and the groom was just 20. The match was nakedly intended for the young man to inherit some of Warwick's substantial family lands when the blushing bride passed away. Second, Edward married his sister to the Duke of Burgundy, thwarting Warwick's long-term plan for a French alliance. Last, and most important, Edward refused to allow his brother George, the Duke of Clarence, to marry Warwick's daughter Isabel. There were good reasons for this. Since Edward had married an Englishwoman, his brother was a valuable commodity on the international marriage market. More than that, it was bad politics for Edward to further bind his family to the most powerful noble in the land. Warwick had enough already. He didn't need any more. Quote, deeply offended by all this, according to one chronicler, Warwick left court and retreated to his estates in 1468. All was not well in England. Old Lancastrian supporters were making trouble. Jasper Tudor invaded. A noble plot to put Henry VI back on the throne came to light, and there was a major popular uprising in the north in 1469. Worst of all, Edward's brother George, Duke of Clarence, was clearly growing close to the disaffected Earl of Warwick. George was a handsome and charming young man, 19 years old in 1469, much like his brother had been on taking the throne. But where his brother had real talents and seemed to effortlessly grasp the impossibly difficult business of kingship, George, Duke of Clarence, was only skin deep. No matter how much Edward gave him, and he made George one of the wealthiest men in England, it was never enough. George was greedy and entitled and not especially smart. The Earl of Warwick fanned the embers of jealousy in the young Duke of Clarence. He also plotted and schemed in his northern stronghold. The major uprising early in 1469 seems to have been a popular affair, but it was quickly followed by a copycat uprising. This second one was a front for a Warwick-led rebellion against Edward IV. In the summer of 1469, Edward was shocked to find a rebel army marching south on London. Worse, his brother George betrayed him. He fled to Calais with Warwick. To confirm this, George went ahead and married Isabel, Warwick's daughter, against Edward's long-standing and explicit wishes. Warwick meant to play the kingmaker once again and replace Edward on the throne with his worthless, disloyal younger brother. Warwick's allies defeated a royal army in battle, and support for Edward's rule melted away practically overnight. Before long, Edward IV himself was captured and thrown in prison. Several of his most powerful noble supporters, including the father and a brother of Queen Elizabeth Woodville, were taken and executed by Warwick and his men. By the late summer of 1469, the man who had been King of England for 8 years was a helpless prisoner of the Earl of Warwick. It's worth stopping for a moment here and taking stock of everything we've talked about. All things considered, Edward IV had done a pretty dang good job as king for 8 years by the time he ended up in Warwick's prison. So how could he have lost his crown in the blink of an eye? This was where decades of instability and open war had led, to deep, destabilizing questions of authority and legitimacy. Who got to rule and why? Edward had taken the throne on a flimsy blood claim, but he had exercised authority and defended his claim in battle. None of that had been enough to rally the kingdom to his side in the face of another challenger. But those same questions of authority and legitimacy dragged Warwick and Clarence down too. They quickly found that an army and holding Edward prisoner wasn't enough for anybody to obey their rule. They had zero authority and somehow even less legitimacy. London exploded into open violence and rioting. The kinds of simmering tensions between noble families that Edward had managed to keep in check for years spilled over into open violence once again. The Duke of Norfolk blasted open a rival family's castle with cannon in just one of the many private wars that broke out. Edward's youngest brother, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, raised an army and rose up in revolt. Yet another revolt began, most dangerously of all, in support of the imprisoned King Henry VI. It was clear that Warwick couldn't govern England, either by himself or in conjunction with his feckless friend George, Duke of Clarence. The only solution was to release Edward IV from prison and pray that he could restore order. By October of 1469, the king was free and going about setting England to rights. The Northern Rebellion went down in flames. The fractious city of London cheered Edward's arrival. He was merciful and magnanimous, even to Warwick and Clarence, who had thrown him in jail and executed his supporters. Friend of the show Dan Jones describes Edward's mood here as one of, quote, ominous good cheer. On the surface, it was like nothing had ever happened. The only real change that came about was Edward elevating his youngest brother Richard, Duke of Gloucester, with more lands and responsibilities. Richard had shown himself to be tough and, above all, loyal. He would become his brother's most trusted ally. For For a few months at the end of 1469 and the beginning of 1470, England was once again quiet. That couldn't last. A private war broke out between a rebel lord and an ally of Edward's, and soon battle lines were drawn. Edward went north with an army, and Warwick jumped in with the rebels. Edward crushed this rebellion in a bloody battle, but papers found on one of the dead rebels revealed that his worthless brother, the Duke of Clarence, had been involved in the plotting. In the aftermath, Clarence and Warwick fled England for Calais. For years, Calais had been Warwick's stronghold, but now the garrison refused to let him in. The only place left to go was France, to the protection of the wily and dangerous King Louis XI, the Universal Spider, as he was known at the time. Two other players had sought and found help from Louis XI. They were the last possible allies for Warwick and Clarence, Queen Margaret of Anjou and her now 17-year-old son, Prince Edward, son of the old and useless Henry VI. Margaret and Prince Edward and their few remaining Lancastrian supporters had been in exile in France for several years by this point, watching and waiting and desperately hoping for an opening to return home. This young Prince Edward was growing into a formidable force. When he was 13, the ambassador to the Duke of Milan wrote that the prince, quote, already talks of nothing but of cutting off heads or making war. Unlike his passive and peace-loving father, King Henry VI, this Prince Edward had the fighting part of kingship on lockdown. Warwick had spent his entire adult life fighting against Queen Margaret, Henry VI, and young Prince Edward. Clarence had only come to power because his brother had deposed Queen Margaret, Henry VI, and young Prince Edward. But by the summer of 1470, Warwick and Clarence had hashed out a deal with Queen Margaret. Prince Edward was to marry one of Warwick's daughters to cement the alliance, and then Warwick would return to England and overthrow King Edward IV. Enough nobles rushed to Warwick's side when he returned to England back in September that things looked pretty grim for the king. This was where King Edward IV showed his true brilliance. He didn't have an army ready. Nobles were leaving him for Warwick, Queen Margaret, and the young Prince Edward. Rather than fighting against increasingly long odds, Edward IV got on a ship and left England for the safety of Flanders, where his brother-in-law, Charles the Bold, ruled as duke. Warwick got old Henry VI out of the tower and paraded him through London as a symbol of the new, or old, order. King Edward wasn't in Flanders for long. His brother-in-law, the Duke of Burgundy, gave him money and ships, and the king returned to England in March of 1471. This was far from a triumphant entry into his kingdom. Edward had only 1,200 men with him, and the nobles of the realm were mostly either sitting on the fence or actively supporting Warwick, Henry VI, and Queen Margaret. Still, King Edward got lucky. He made his way through the north, drawing supporters to his side. His brother Richard joined him, as did Elizabeth Woodville's family. Finally, most important of all, Edward managed to convince his brother George to abandon Warwick and join him. King Edward IV entered London in triumph on April 11, 1471. When Warwick's supporters abandoned the city, they hadn't even bothered to take old King Henry VI with them. Dressed in a dreary, threadbare blue gown, his authority and legitimacy long since gone, Henry surrendered to Edward. Quote, "My cousin of York, you are very welcome," the old king said. Henry was just tired of it all. Edward IV was in his prime. He wasn't tired of anything. He left London with his army and went after Warwick, meeting him near Barnet, about 10 miles outside the city, on April 14th. In a foggy, confused mess of a fight, King Edward fought in the front rank. His soldiers beat back Warwick's men, and Warwick himself tried to flee into some woods. The wily Warwick had escaped his doom many times before, but this time he had reached the end. Edward's men killed him on the spot. Years of plotting and scheming and double-dealing had led him to a brutal death in a nondescript copse of trees. In the aftermath, Edward publicly displayed Warwick's near-naked body, covered in wounds, for all the world to see. There could be no doubt that the Earl was dead. But the war wasn't over yet. While Warwick had been trying to take England on behalf of King Henry VI, Margaret of Anjou, and the young Prince Edward, the Queen and her son were waiting in France. As Warwick died amid the trees at Barnet on Easter Sunday, Prince Edward and Queen Margaret were landing on the shores of England with an army. They immediately set about rallying Lancastrian nobles to their side and put together a substantial force. Edward's forces had been bloodied badly at Barnet, and he had to rush to put together another army. The king drove his forces hard in pursuit of Queen Margaret and Prince Edward and their supporters, covering 31 miles in 12 hours to finally reach them. Edward IV caught up with the Lancastrians at Tewkesbury in Gloucestershire, about 100 miles northwest of London. The battlefield was full of obstacles and blind alleys created by ditches, hedges, woods, and small hills and valleys. King Edward IV used the terrain masterfully. He hid soldiers in some trees and then sent them crashing into the Lancastrians' flanks as the two armies engaged. The Lancastrians broke and ran, and the battle turned into a rout. Young Prince Edward, the would-be heir who had loved the idea of war so much, found battle a harsh reality. He was cut down begging for mercy. All of the other Lancastrian nobles that Edward IV could find on the battlefield were killed. Still more were dragged out of the churches where they had sought sanctuary. They were tried, informally, and beheaded. Queen Margaret, shattered by the death of her son, was taken prisoner in a monastery. On May 21st, 1471, King Edward IV re-entered London in triumph. That very same night, old King Henry VI died in the Tower of London. This was supposedly a natural death. The blood dripping from his head onto the floor of St. Paul's Cathedral, where his body was publicly displayed the next day, betrayed the lie. He had probably been bludgeoned to death. With Henry VI's death, practically every major figure on the Lancastrian side was dead or captured. Edward IV could rule England without fear of rebellion. He had won the Wars of the Roses.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Just as Prince Edward was crying out for mercy on the battlefield at Tewkesbury, a 14-year-old boy was riding through the rolling hills of South Wales with his uncle and their retainers. They were on their way to join the prince in his cause. They were still 50 miles from Tewkesbury when word reached them of the disaster. There would be no glorious Lancastrian restoration, no disbursement of rich estates and lucrative offices. It was over. 4 months later, after weeks of dodging royal agents sent by Edward IV to capture and then behead them, the boy and his uncle stepped onto the rocking deck of a tiny ship off the coast of Wales. The steel-gray September sky loomed overhead, threatening rain. Only a pathetic few attendants remained with the boy and his uncle. The others were long since dead or fled. This 14-year-old was the last real Lancastrian left. His name was Henry Tudor. He and his uncle Jasper were about to flee for the safety of France. We've met a couple of Tudors here and there. Old Owen Tudor, the second husband of Queen Catherine de Valois, the widow of Henry V and the mother of Henry VI, and Jasper Tudor, son of Owen Tudor and Queen Catherine, staunch supporter of his half-brother Henry VI and one of the fiercest, most talented Lancastrian nobles. Jasper had a brother named Edmund Tudor, who was likewise a friend and partisan of Queen Margaret and the Lancastrians. Unlike Jasper, who fought for Henry VI and Queen Margaret all the way up to Tewkesbury, Edmund had died young in 1456, just 26 years old. Before he died, Edmund Tudor had married a 12-year-old girl named Margaret Beaufort. Margaret was a niece of the powerful Duke of Somerset, the richest heiress in England, and had old royal blood. She was the great-great-granddaughter of King Edward III. When her husband died, the barely teenaged Margaret was pregnant. Aged 13 in January of 1457, Margaret Beaufort gave birth to a son named Henry Tudor. The young Henry had more French royal blood than English, but when he escaped to the continent after Tewkesbury, he was the last real Lancastrian figure left with even the most distant claim on the throne. As we saw, his uncle Jasper had gone with him. So did a few other diehard Lancastrians. They were all that was left of a once powerful cause. With the resistance either dead on the battlefield or executed in the aftermath, Edward IV went about ruling England. He did a remarkably good job of it, enough so that some recent historians rank him as one of the best kings of the entire Middle Ages and beyond. After decades of instability and open civil war, Edward succeeded in uniting the entire kingdom around the person of the king. That sounds basic. It had been the norm in England for most of the past few centuries. But we have to remember that basically nobody alive in 1471 had seen a king exercise power the way he was supposed to without active resistance. Edward had learned from years of hard experience that the king's main job was managing the high nobility. He needed to keep them happy or at least satisfied. He needed to make them feel like they were involved in government and that their concerns and complaints were being heard. He needed to mediate the disputes that grew up between them. It helped if he could make war, because then he could personally involve the nobility in a common project. If the king could do all that, then he could stop the chain reaction of political instability that shot downward from the king to the nobles to the gentry to the common people. If he could do all of that, then just maybe Edward IV could stay on the throne. Edward excelled at all of this on both a personal and a theoretical level. He was charming and charismatic and built deep relationships with some of the kingdom's greatest nobles. They wanted to be around Edward. To feast with him, drink with him, go to tournaments with him, and attend his wild, debauched sexual escapades. His royal court was full of glittering spectacle and ritual, modeled directly on the sophisticated Burgundians just on the other side of the channel. Edward was a fun guy with a flair for big, dramatic occasions, ceremonies, and parties. The nobles were drawn to that. The king was also an accomplished and talented soldier, yet another thing the nobles liked. Edward made one stab at going back to war with France in 1475. He got Parliament to grant him a tax, he put together a big and intimidating army, and crossed the channel just long enough to get the French king, Louis XI, to pay him a massive amount of money to go away. In that last bit, Edward getting paid both to go to war and to stop going to war, we can see some of the king's more abstract talents for rulership. Royal finances had been a mess throughout Henry VI's reign. But Edward grasped the importance of getting the crown back on a sound monetary footing. In public, the royal court was full of rich display and opulence. In private, it was run on an exceptionally tight budget, with every expense noted in voluminous account books. Beyond his attractive personality and his understanding of money, Edward also grasped how to keep order in his kingdom. He created what were effectively regional commands and put his most trusted noble associates in charge of them. The Woodvilles, the Queen's family, were some of the major beneficiaries. So was Edward's brother Richard, Duke of Gloucester, who kept watch on the dangerous Scottish borderlands and the fractious nobles who lived up there. With order at the top of the political spectrum, royal government could extend down into the counties and shires deeper than it ever had before. In fact, Edward's royal legal apparatus was so effective at providing legal services that he was basically cutting the nobility out of the law and order business altogether. Justice was rapidly becoming the king's justice. From 1471 to 1483, Edward IV ruled England with skill and to the general satisfaction of its political community. The only incident to mar this period of calm was one final screw-up from Edward's useless brother George, Duke of Clarence. It's complicated and not especially important, but the affair ended with George's execution on charges of treason. Maybe, as the story goes, poor George was executed by being drowned in a cask of wine. By 1482, Edward even felt secure enough to begin negotiating to bring Henry Tudor, the last Lancastrian, home from France. Henry's formidable mother, Margaret Beaufort, had spent years rehabilitating herself and the family in order to recover some of her son's lands and titles. Edward was only 40 years old. He had two sons and a whole bunch of daughters. His dynasty seemed secure both in the present and for the future. There was nothing more to fear from the now 25-year-old Henry Tudor, holed up in the Duchy of Brittany with just a few renegade supporters. As 1483 dawned, nobody could have foreseen what happened next. In late March of that year, King Edward, just shy of his 41st birthday, was taken ill. He wasn't old, but years of debauched living had taken their toll. In his youth, the king had been tall, strong, broad-chested, and active. As he grew into comfortable middle age, he took a hard turn towards soft living. Quote, "In food and drink, he was immoderate. He had grown fat in the loins," wrote an Italian ambassador. The great Burgundian diplomat Philippe de Comines wrote that Edward, quote, loved to indulge himself in ease and pleasures. And a later historian wrote that the king was, quote, given to bodily lust. The likeliest scenario was that Edward was suffering from the late stages of kidney disease brought on by overindulgence. He died on April 9th. Edward IV had been many things, but the least of them was a fool. His eldest son, also, and confusingly, named Edward, was still only 12 years old in 1483. The boy had been brought up to rule, and he was surrounded by trusted, talented counselors. Foremost among them was the boy's uncle Anthony Woodville, Earl Rivers, the brother of Queen Elizabeth. Anthony Woodville was said to be the finest knight in England. He was a pious, talented warrior with a passion for the new humanistic learning coming out of Italy. There could be no better overseer for the future king than this chivalrous nobleman. As Edward IV lay dying, he tried to establish a solution to rule England until his son came of age. Anthony Woodville would continue to watch over the young Edward. He would share power with the skilled and talented Richard, Duke of Gloucester, brother of Edward IV. Richard, Duke of Gloucester, had defined his entire life and career by service to his brother. While still a teenager, he had raised troops and fought hard to support Edward IV during the 1469 to 1471 phase of the wars. Since then, he had proven himself to be a tough soldier, a dedicated administrator, and a savvy politician. He had never shown anything other than extreme loyalty. It may have been him who bludgeoned old King Henry VI to death on his brother's orders. The Duke was 30 years old when Edward IV died. He was slim and shorter than his giant of a brother. He was already showing the effects of severe scoliosis, which raised one shoulder higher than the other and caused him considerable pain. While not physically imposing, he was dogged and determined and had a tendency to make decisive decisions under pressure. What became clear very quickly was that the settlement Edward IV had envisioned, power sharing between the Woodville clan and Richard, was fraught with difficulties. The Woodvilles had always been grasping and power hungry. Whatever Anthony Woodville's personal qualities, with him in charge of the king's household, it would be hard for him not to act like the leader of a faction. For his part, Richard thought, with good reason, that he was the preeminent nobleman in England. He should be protector and make the decisions while the young King Edward was a boy. The question of who got to wield royal authority was the central problem that had caused the Wars of the Roses in the first place. It was about to rise up once again. As the young king and his uncle Anthony rode toward London to make preparations for the coronation, Richard rode out to meet him. They passed a night in pleasant conversation and ate a fine meal. The next day on the road, seemingly out of the blue, Richard and his allies arrested Anthony Woodville and sent him away to prison. The Duke dismissed all of the young king's attendants and told him that they were safeguarding his rule against the greed and danger of the Woodville family. Edward protested. Quote, he had seen nothing evil in them and wished to keep them unless otherwise proved, he said to Richard. But this wasn't a negotiation. The young King Edward wasn't in charge. He was now just as much a prisoner as his uncle Anthony. Richard and the king soon entered London, but the Duke didn't stop there. He cut out additional Woodvilles from any role in government and claimed that they were planning to rebel against him. Queen Elizabeth fled to the safety of Sanctuary. She took with her daughters and her second son, the 9-year-old Richard, Duke of York. The Woodvilles had been defanged, and the king was a prisoner. But what was Richard supposed to do now? As May and June of 1483 wore on, the tensions mounted. Richard grew increasingly desperate. He summoned soldiers from his lands in the north and started to look for an excuse to have Anthony Woodville and the rest of his enemies removed for good. Meanwhile, he managed to get the young Duke of York, the second son of old King Edward, away from his mother. Now he had both of Edward IV's sons and heirs as his prisoners. When Richard made his final decision, he did so with shocking speed and decisiveness. First, he had Anthony Woodville and his other prisoners executed for treason. Next, he maneuvered some of his erstwhile allies, people who could implicate him in the crimes he had already committed, into a trap in the Tower of London where he had them killed. Finally, Richard put out a shocking and entirely made-up propaganda message that the young King Edward and his brother were illegitimate and therefore not eligible to inherit the throne. Old King Edward IV's marriage to Elizabeth Woodville had never been legal, Richard said, and thus his sons were bastards. He, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, was the legitimate King of England. What followed was a tragedy. the two young princes were locked up in the Tower of London, and they were never heard from again. They were probably killed a few months later, but we'll never know for sure who did the deed, when, or precisely why the decision was made to execute two innocent children. Richard was crowned king as Richard III and set about ruling his brother's kingdom. Over on the continent, the potential for Henry Tudor to return to England and live the life of a wealthy noble was gone for good. Edward IV had been secure enough to have the last Lancastrian return home. Edward III was patently not that secure. There was only one course left for Henry Tudor: to return to England and stake his claim on the throne itself. By 1483, now aged 26, Henry Tudor had grown into a sharp political mind. He was slender and had a taste for expensive, dyed-black clothing. His years of exile, of living on the political edge, had made him a keen observer of the people and happenings around him. His gaze was penetrating, and he asked incisive, probing questions in fluent French and English. Most of all, Henry Tudor trusted absolutely nobody except his innermost circle of fellow exiles, especially his uncle Jasper. The Duke of Buckingham had been Richard III's most important and really only ally in his coup. But Buckingham was vain and greedy and power-hungry, and the opportunistic Henry Tudor made plans with Buckingham to overthrow Richard III in turn. Buckingham began his rebellion too early in the fall of 1483, while Henry was still in the process of crossing the Channel with men and ships. Soon, Buckingham's rebellion had been crushed, and the Duke's head parted company with his shoulders. In early November, Henry's supporters declared him the rightful king. He made landfall on the English coast and spotted lookouts, but the seasoned exile could smell a trap. The lookouts were Richard's men, waiting to capture and execute Henry. Tudor turned back around and headed for the continent. He would try again later. With Henry Tudor back in the Duchy of Brittany and then France, Richard III went about consolidating his rule. England fell in line with remarkable speed, if not great enthusiasm. Richard might have been one of history's great villains. It's hard not to apply that label to a man who deposed and murdered his young nephews, and Shakespeare has certainly enhanced that reputation over the years. But Richard was gifted with the right stuff for rulership. He tried to provide strong royal justice. He showed a sharp understanding of finances. He generally did about as good a job as anybody could expect. But there was no way around the basic fact that Richard III had usurped the crown on the flimsiest possible grounds. He was wielding authority, but he had zero legitimacy. Moreover, he had made many enemies in his lightning coup. The Woodville survivors and the diehard supporters of old King Edward increasingly fled England to join up with Henry Tudor, who was now openly styling himself King of England. The most damaging blow to Richard came when Henry Tudor completed negotiations with Queen Elizabeth Woodville to marry Elizabeth of York, the eldest daughter of Edward IV. To many powerful people within England, the young princess represented everything that had been good and just about her father's reign. She was his heir. If she married Henry Tudor, there would be a strong coalition to face Richard III. In one of the more bonkers events of this entire wild period, Richard III apparently strongly considered marrying Elizabeth of York himself, his own niece, to forestall this possibility. Even for a man who had deposed and murdered his nephews, this was a step too far. Richard III was publicly forced to declare that he had no intention of marrying his dead brother's daughter. But despite that denial, the possibility was still too much for Henry Tudor to bear. If Richard married Elizabeth of York or otherwise took her off the board, Henry was done for. His future legitimacy as King of England rested on uniting the Yorkist and Lancastrian claims by marrying Elizabeth. It was time to do or die. Tudor borrowed a modest amount of money from the King of France. The would-be King of England used it to hire ships and a small collection of mercenaries, some of them dragged out of the jails of Normandy and set sail for Wales. He hoped the nobles of England would join him. There were still old Lancastrian sympathizers hanging around. Henry was the heir to that tradition. Through his hopefully upcoming marriage to Elizabeth of York, he counted on the support of the Yorkists as well. Still, things looked bleak. The Burgundian statesman Philippe de Comines wrote that Henry was, quote, without power, without money, without right to the crown of England. Upon arriving in Wales, Henry Tudor raised the banner of the dragon, the old Welsh emblem of his family. Allies didn't exactly flock to his side, but they didn't rush to crush him either. reinforcements trickled in. Others, like the powerful Stanley family, raised their troops and took to the field but didn't actively join him or oppose him. They were waiting to see what happened. Richard III gathered an army, mostly composed of his northern loyalists, and headed into the field to crush the usurper. Richard may have betrayed his brother's memory and murdered his nephews, but nobody ever doubted his bravery. As the two armies sized each other up near the village of Bosworth on August 22, 1485, Richard told his companions, quote, he would make in either of war or life. He rode into battle wearing his royal crown. The early morning sunlight glinted off the blades of swords and pole axes. It shone on the polished plates of steel armor and the bronze barrels of cannon. The two armies clanked into place, separated by a series of ripening wheat fields. Horses whinnied and neighed. Men prayed and shouted to break the dangerous tedium. Then the real noise began, as guns unleashed gouts of flame, bowstrings snapped and twanged, and arrows whizzed through the air. The two lines crashed into one another with the clang of steel on steel and the wet smack of blades into flesh. Spying Henry Tudor fighting under his dragon banner, Richard spurred his horse onward and determined to kill him with his own hand. The king slammed into Tudor's bodyguard with such force that the standard bearer was killed and the dragon banner fell to the ground. But then disaster struck. The Stanley family had been hanging back from the battle with some 3,000 men, waiting to see who was winning so they could throw in their lot with the victors. At this critical moment, the Stanleys chose Henry Tudor. Fresh Stanley retainers flooded onto the field at Bosworth, and somewhere in the melee, Richard III fell. He had either lost or removed his helmet, and that was what killed him. Glancing blows from bladed weapons sheared off chunks of his scalp and hair. Two lethal blows did him in. The first was a cut from a halberd or poleaxe that removed the back of his skull and exposed his brain. Another bladed weapon had stabbed through the right side of his skull. Two more wounds to the chin and cheek, probably dagger thrusts, made sure that he was dead. The corpse was stripped naked and slung over the back of a horse. Someone thrust a dagger through its buttock so hard that it scored the bone of his pelvis underneath. We know all these gory details because Richard III's corpse was recently discovered, exhumed, and examined. His skeleton tells a grisly story of just what happened to hated kings killed in battle. Henry Tudor was triumphant. He was the last king standing, and soon he would date his reign from the day before the Battle of Bosworth. That meant anybody who had opposed him was a traitor and subject to the penalties thereof. Soon after, he married Elizabeth of York, uniting the two warring factions of York and Lancaster in a new ruling house, the Tudor dynasty, which would rule England from 1485 to 1603. The Wars of the Roses were nearly done. Henry VII, as he was soon crowned, was the most unlikely of kings. The grandson of a Welsh chamber servant and a French princess, an exile for practically all his life, he had seized the throne on the field of battle. But taking the crown wasn't enough. Now, Henry Tudor had to rule England. Remember, there were two intertwined questions that plagued every king after Henry V. Questions first of authority, of how to wield power, and second, of legitimacy, of what gave the king the right to exercise that power. Henry VII wielded power and did so with great effectiveness, but his legitimacy was always in question. He faced full-on invasion by a rebel earl in 1487, and various pretenders to the throne were a constant worry throughout his reign. Despite his obvious competence and ruthlessness, Henry was never entirely secure on the throne. By the end of his reign, Henry VII kept his subjects in a state of quiet terror with brutal financial demands and omnipresent spy networks. He was, as one recent historian called him, a winter king. Quote, conscience is a word that cowards use, devised at first to keep the strong in awe, said Shakespeare's Richard III. That applies just as well to Henry VII. Only with the rise of his larger-than-life son, Henry VIII, would England truly return to something like normalcy. For 72 years, from 1437 to 1509, England was rocked by political instability and occasional bouts of extreme violence. Dozens of members of the kingdom's greatest noble families and thousands upon thousands of lesser mortals were killed, either dead on the battlefield or executed for crimes both real and perceived. Kings and dynasties had risen and fallen. Some aspects of the political system had remained stable, but others had changed forever. Henry VII never trusted his nobles, and with good reason. Instead, he promoted low-born lawyers and bureaucrats, financial wizards and vicious opportunists, whose only allegiance was to the king. That was much different from the noble-centric rule of old King Henry V, victor of Agincourt and conqueror of France. Times had changed. Medieval government was evolving into something new, a different arrangement of power. And the Wars of the Roses were the reason for that. Next time on Tides of History, we'll be expanding our focus from England to Western Europe more broadly. England wasn't the only kingdom experiencing civil wars and political upheaval in the second half of the 15th century, and we'll explore exactly why that was happening everywhere around this time. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound designer is Lindsey Graham. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.